Thank you for attending our talk today. I'm going to be discussing Thelemic magic, our unique form of spirituality at OTO. How many magical practitioners are there in the room? Oh, everyone. Magic is it's a unique spiritual path. And I think that if you've been practicing magic for a while, it's easy to overlook what is unique about it. I'm going to talk about my own spiritual path, but my guess is that you'll probably be able to relate to a lot of what I'm about to say about magic. Magic has a unique relationship with sensuality, mm-hmm. with sensation. I wasn't able to set up an altar today, but you're familiar with things like incense and candles and magical weapons, and all the trappings that go into ceremonial magic are a large part of the enjoyment of it, I think. But I think at a deep level, it really speaks to the relationship that we have with sensuality and with the body on this particular spiritual path. I think that's conspicuous if you compare the magical path with a renunciate spiritual path, like, for example, classical Buddhism, the teachings of the Buddha and the Pali Suttas. Buddhism, the renunciate spiritual paths tend to reject or pull away from what's called gross forms of sensuality. Gross, not in the sense of being disgusting, but just being obvious sources of trouble. Like, one of the key ones in Buddhism is money. Buddhist monks don't handle money. They don't engage in any kind of commerce. They collect alms. They live on charity. And it's easy to see why. If you personally aren't having any money problems right now, you know somebody who is. That's a really common source of stress and distress in life. And so you can see how it would be perfectly logical and consistent to just say, hey, you know, instead of playing that game, let's just not deal with that aspect of existence at all. Perfectly logical response to it. In Buddhism, this also applies to sexuality, romantic love, even intimacy. We get a lot of joy out of romantic love and intimacy and sexuality. It's incredibly powerful and incredibly enjoyable. But everybody knows it's also dangerous. Everybody's been hurt in some way in and through love. It's just the other side of it. And so, and even if you haven't, even if you have a wonderful relationship with someone, you know that, you know, one or the other is probably going to die before the other. And you see, there's always that loss that goes with it, or the possibility of loss. And so, again, you could see that how it would be a logical response to that to say, well, okay, since I'm going to get the bad with the good with that, why don't I just take my hands off of it altogether and not deal with it? It's a logical response. Makes sense. And then there are other techniques in renunciate traditions, for example, deep states of meditation to deal with what are known as the finer forms of sensuality and enjoyment. And the goal of a lot of those practices is to bring an end to becoming, to bring an end to generation, and to just get off the ride completely, and to move away from existence, which is impermanent and unreliable, and move to something that just doesn't change at all, something independent of this material universe, where you can find peace and stability and happiness. Just get off the ride. And you know, it's a very easy to understand reaction to things. Now, the magical path, on the other hand, seems to go almost in the exact opposite direction. Because as magical practitioners, we don't recoil from sensuality. In fact, different modes of sensation and sensuality are divine. So for example, different colors are associated with different planets and different zodiacal signs. And so we incorporate those into rituals. Different smells, different kinds of perfume or incense are beloved by different gods, goddesses, and spirits. So we use those in our rituals. Different sounds, different kinds of music are important to ritual. Even taste, even touch. We say of earth that it's cool and dry, and that air is warm and moist. All of the different modes of sensuality have divine aspects to them. We can activate a divine quality in them. And so they are actually integral parts of this path. Of course, you could do magic entirely in your head, but most people don't. We bring in all of these different modes of sensuality. Now, when you're talking about the sensations, so when you're talking about the five senses, inescapably, you're talking about the physical body, the fact that we have bodies. So to put sensation at the center of a spiritual practice is really to place the human body at the center of what we do. Which on the face of it is kind of odd. Considering that most of the kinds of suffering that we experience, or most of the kinds of stress that we endure in life, relate back in some way to the physical body, to the fact that we are physical beings. We're not just spiritual beings, we're not just intellectual beings, we can be impinged upon by this reality and by other people. And in a certain sense, it's a form of weakness, or of at least vulnerability. And so it's rather odd when you think about it that at the center of a spiritual approach to life, at that point of greatest power and of greatest strength and of greatest importance, would be that which makes us the most vulnerable. It's an odd paradox. You find a similar motif in Christianity. I mean, think of the highest, most powerful concept of God that you could form, completely unlimited, unconditioned, all-powerful, outside of space and time, able to create an entire universe, completely impervious to all things. And put it in a man. How the hell is that supposed to work? Christians aren't even clear on this. They've been trying to figure this one out for almost 2,000 years. And despite having, you know, multiple councils to try to nail this down, they still end up disagreeing over it. I mean, I couldn't explain it to you. And so it involves taking that which is impervious and making it vulnerable. And of course, the stories about Jesus are obviously intended, the way they're written, to make it clear that he was supposed to be the best a man could possibly be. That was clearly the intention, you know, for its time and place. That was the idea behind it. And then take the best a person could possibly be, and then let just the worst things happen to him as a result of being the best a person could possibly be. The best kind of human being, and just treated as unfairly as you could possibly imagine. And then somehow, by means of this, overcome the condition of suffering completely, transcend it. Again, it's a paradox. Two things slapped together that on the face of it don't make any sense at all. And yet, that story resonates with something inside of us, something beyond reason, to the point where billions of people's lives have been changed because of it. They're hyper-motivated by it. That's the structure and the power of an archetypal myth. Take a story that's just so contradictory, it doesn't make any sense, it pushes everything to the limits, buries all the needles, and to the point of being nonsense, and then people's lives change because of it. They live in accordance with it. That's basically what archetype is. The Hebrew word for Messiah, Messiah, has the same numerical value as the Hebrew word Nechesh, which means serpent. Now, if you are a good occultist, you know that when two words have an identical numerical value, especially if they seem to have absolutely nothing to do with one another and even contradict one another, there has to be some kind of underlying, hidden, occult connection between these two things. In the case of the Messiah, you already have a completely bonkers story about an individual who went so deeply into suffering as to somehow pass through out the other side and basically either become God in certain tellings of the story or, you know, return to being God. It depends what your Christology is, but he transcended it is the point. And then on the other hand, you have this story about the serpent in the Garden of Eden, who manages to trick Eve and then Adam into eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the way that he tricked them was he said, if you eat of this tree, you'll be like gods. And so they went and ate it. And what happens? What happened to them when they ate it? What happened immediately after eating that fruit?
He blamed it on the woman.
They're embarrassed.
Before that, you got it. They were ashamed. It's literally the next sentence. They experienced the pain of the knowledge of their own existence. And then he blamed it on the woman, and they got kicked out of the garden, and they were ejected into what in Buddhism would be samsara. They'd be rejected into suffering, the human condition that we know and loathe. So on the one hand, in the case of the Messiah, you have a movement into suffering that transcends it. And in the other case, in the case of the serpent, you have individuals who are already in a divine state. They couldn't realize it, but they were already in paradise. And the serpent's like, oh, you want to be gods? If they had understood their own condition, they would have said, no, you know, it's cool. We got this. But they didn't have self-consciousness. And so then they are ejected out into a realm of suffering. One is a path up, the other a path down. People have been fascinated by serpents probably as long as they've been aware, because snakes exist in every single human environment. I think. part of the fascination with serpents comes from the fact that they shed their skins. So they become natural symbols of rebirth, of regeneration. So that's clearly part of it. And of course you have the image of the serpent biting its own tail, the Ouroboros. Regeneration, renewal. But snakes are also dangerous. Some of them, their bite can kill you, or at least injure you. And they tend to be under rocks in the desert, or in the tall grass, or dangling from trees that you might walk under. They're concealed, they're hidden. And so if you're gonna go out walking, go looking for some food, or take a trip to your neighbor's house, you really better watch where you're stepping. You better watch out for them. They tend to invoke on their own a heightened sense of awareness, of like paying attention. And maybe for that reason, snakes are associated with the quality of being awake, of being conscious. And at its extreme end, some kind of spiritual enlightenment. In a certain sense, the snake, the serpent, is an apt symbol of life itself. The dangerousness, the inherent dangerousness of existence. And the fact that if you're going to survive long in this world at all, you had better pay attention to the things going on around you. The movement into reality, into life, right? If we're not going to recoil from life, approaching sensuousness, approaching these issues of the body and vulnerability is in a certain sense requires the same caution and awareness that you would require to approach something dangerous, like a snake, but which also gives the gift of enlightenment. Rather than putting a stop to consciousness, as we might if we were trying to get off the ride, the path inward requires a heightening of a consciousness, a more intense engagement with the senses and with awareness. Now, from a renunciate perspective, that would seem just insane. Like, why are you going near the snake? It's a fucking snake. Don't you see that it's a snake? Stay back. It's insane if you go toward it with the expectation that nothing bad will happen to you. It's insane if you go toward it with the expectation that you are in control of the situation. You are not. The spiritual path that I follow is called thelema. Does anybody know what thelema means? Somebody not in the front row? It's just the Greek word for will, as in the Lord's Prayer. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Whatever will means, it does not mean arranging the conditions of your life such that you always get what you want. It's actually not about control and manipulation. That's not it. Because that can't be it. Reality is not set up to allow that. At least not for any meaningful length of time, right? If you try to have it both ways, if you say, okay, I'm not gonna get off the ride because that sucks. I really enjoy sex and tacos and everything else and money, and this is really cool, okay? I don't want to do that. That's silly. But then, so you go the other way, say, okay, I'm going to participate in this world. I'm going to be part of life. You know, but only so long as I get it my way. That's where the insanity lies. Because that's that. There's a false premise in there. Well, there's a few false premises, but the idea that you can control what any of this is going to do relies upon you having a sense of a part of you that somehow stands outside of this. Like a little controller or an ego, some little person sitting maybe about an inch behind your eyeballs, you know, pulling levers like this. A sense of separateness, a controller who controls the world. And the problem with that point of view, well, there's several problems, but number one, everything we know about how the brain works says that that's just wrong. That's not how it's set up at all. And number two, to maintain that particular delusion requires the mobilization of primitive psychological mechanisms. Things that end up causing more trouble than they solve. It ends up leading to putting up various forms of armor around yourself, around your heart. Imagine for a moment that you overhear your spouse or your significant other mocking your sexual performance to another person. That sensation that you may have just had right here was your heart closing like a clamshell. Closing against something that already just happened to it, but that's the defense coming up. That is the attempt to wall yourself off from life at an emotion, at a very core level of emotion and of identity. That particular posture toward existence, the closed position, Aleister Crowley equates that or makes an analogy between that and the Virgin Mary, of trying to seal oneself off in some kind of pure little spot that where you can't be hurt. Part of the spiritual path that I follow involves in those situations when the heart closes or wants to close, to try as best as possible to open it up and to not allow that to happen. To remain affirmative, awake and aware, and to not condemn being. In other words, not succumb to resentment. And as one follows that path of opening the heart and of keeping the heart open, this is a path that leads to Our Lady Babylon. A goddess who Crowley describes as a whore, a harlot. Why? Because it is an attitude of acceptance of what may come. The thalamic path is a path of heart. But to do this requires Well, it requires a few things, but probably the most, massive courage. Massive amounts of courage. That's a practice. Has anyone here ever read a book called A Wizard of Earthsea? Oh, guys, really? Oh, my God.
Maybe 20 years ago, but...
Oh, my God, you were...
I don't remember anything about it.
Oh, my God. Okay, so for the rest of you who haven't read it, first of all, shame. 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 It's one of my favorite books. It's a beautiful book. Ursula K. Le Guin. Oh, my God, it's one of my favorite books. Okay. Well, shame, shame. So for those of you who haven't read it, it involves, I'm not going to spoil the thing for you, but let me give you the contours of it. It is about a young magician named Ged. And at the beginning of the story, Ged does something pretty stupid. And like so many stupid things we do, he does it out of hubris. He does it out of arrogance. Pride, really, I guess. And so he spends the rest of the book basically dealing with the consequences of this boneheaded, arrogant decision that he made, right? And then toward the end of the second act of the book, after he's gotten his ass kicked up one side of the world and down the other, he runs into his old mentor, a powerful, wise wizard named Ogion. And Ogion gives him a piece of advice. It's two words. He says to him, turn around. Turn around. Face what you fear. Turn around and face what you fear, or else it will control you for as long as you live. Turn around. And so he does. He turns around and faces the darkness that he fears. And he not only undoes the harm that he did, he becomes whole. And true to what Ogion said, he could never be controlled ever again. The path of heart is not without its risks. In fact, it could kill you. Just like life could kill you. Life has a tendency to do that. It eventually kills you. Makes something else out of you. It's going to happen anyway, I guess. Ordo Templi Orientis, the organization that I'm a member of, that I'm here representing, we offer different opportunities for people to practice opening in various ways. I still remember the first time that I attended an OTO event. I had just moved to Seattle, and I was aware that OTO was in Seattle, but it was only after getting into this apartment that I went online and I searched, and they were holding a ritual that weekend, a Gnostic Mass. I said, oh boy, I should go check this out. And so the weekend came, and I was feeling kind of nervous because, you know, I'm walking into the unknown. And who knows what's going to happen? What are these people going to be like? Are they going to be Satanists? Are they going to be the good kind of Satanists or the bad kind of Satanists? Because you got your good Satanists and your bad Satanists. And so I drove over to the neighborhood. We used to be over by the Space Needle down on Dexter Avenue. And I drove over there. And I got out of my car, and I said, this is it. And I walked up to the front door, and I walked right past it. And I just kept going. I said, okay, all right. And so I got to walk around the block first. Let me walk around the block. All right. So I went around the block and I kind of got myself ready to do it. I'm like, okay, this is gonna be it. And so I went up the front door, and again, I went right by it. I went past it. And I said to myself, you know, you're being so silly. You know you're gonna do this. I'm always the kind of person, like, I'm always gonna do it. I'm always gonna jump off. I just have to kind of talk myself into it a little bit. And so finally, I think I only went around the block twice. I think. So then I finally got up the nerve and I went in, and you know, everybody was perfectly normal and nice, and I took my seat in the pew, and then as the ritual was going on, there's a part of the ritual at the end where you go up and you take communion. And communion is you eat this little, it's called the cake of light, but it's sort of like a small cookie basically. And you drink a glass of wine or of juice. And while I was sitting there waiting to go up to take communion, I was like, I was just so scared that I was gonna go up and like not be able to drink a full glass of wine. I was afraid that I couldn't drink wine. I just imagined it like coming out of my nose or something and just making an ass of myself. And at this point, I've probably had, you know, several hundred glasses of communion wine. Not once has it come out of my nose. So it was fine. Interestingly, in that ritual, one of the ritual implements, well, is a cup. And the cup is largely is symbolic of what I've been talking about. This path of heart. Of course, the cup is also symbolic of the yoni. And in the way Crowley wrote the ritual, you're sort of hit over the head with these aspects of it. You know, the first time somebody sees the ritual and they see, you know, the priest and the priestess depress the lance into the cup, they're like, oh, I know what that means. That's really hard to understand, right? But there's a bit more to it than that, because if you look at the symbol of Ordo Templi Orientis, I don't know if you're not going to be able to see it on here, but if you look, it's in the shape of what's called a Vesica Pisces. And at the bottom of it, you can come up and look at it afterwards if you like. There's a cup at the bottom of it. And the cup has some flames coming out of it. And there's a six-petal flower around it, which is symbolic of the Anahata chakra. And there is a heart sitting in the cup. Your heart is not in your vagina. I mean, it shouldn't be. I hope it's not. You should get that checked out. Again, it's the symbology of the heart. We offer other opportunities to practice walking this path. One of probably the most fun and interesting way to do this, in my opinion, is through our series of initiations. Initiations are an opportunity to place trust in yourself as you walk into the unknown. And to practice that in a sacred context. It is an opportunity which is no longer afforded to many people in modern life, unfortunately, but we have preserved it in our mystery school, which is kind of cool. We also provide a community of individuals who are walking the Thelemic spiritual path. Thelema is a highly individualistic religion, and you will find people of all different walks of life involved with it who interpret it and practice it in very different ways. And so naturally, when you're constantly interacting with people with strong opinions, and many of those opinions are different from yours, it gives you a lot of opportunity to practice acceptance. Acceptance of what's arising in you and acceptance of what's happening outside of you. Again, in a structured, safe environment. We offer lots of different opportunities to come learn about us and our community. A great spot to go to learn more is seattle-oto.org. We offer public celebrations of the Gnostic Mass, first and third Sundays of every month. We hang out afterwards. It's a good time to chat with people and ask questions and find out about our community. We have a lovely series of classes coming up this spring and this summer on the Thelemic Arts. There are going to be classes on scrying, initiation, sigil magic, the magical power of art, true will, Gnosticism. They are a la carte classes. You can come to as many or as few of them as you'd like. If you'd like to learn more, please come up and grab a flyer or a postcard before you leave, or go to seattle-oto.org. We also have a class coming up on March 14th. Jim Barker, a palmist, is going to be explaining and talking about mudras in Tarot. Another opportunity to come and meet our community. I've left a few minutes here. I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about, like, I understand how Sir Pearly worked with the Golden Dawn and the ceremonial magical orders, and yet we're here today at concentric circles. Can you talk about where are the connections, crossroads with modern neo-paganism and or not with Thelema? I think there's some overlap, but not necessarily. It'd be interesting to understand a little better some of the comparisons and contrasts.
Sure. So Crowley's background was very eclectic. He happily admitted that he believed in all of the gods and goddesses and worshipped all of them. That's basically what he said. And he incorporated different kinds of devotional practices to various gods and goddesses throughout his life. And he even practiced prayer in the Muslim tradition, Islamic prayer. So he was highly eclectic. And a lot of Thelemic practitioners are also highly eclectic in the same way. Crowley also made room for atheism, as it turns out. And there are ways to interpret his philosophy that are more secular, that don't really make reference at all to any gods or goddesses. I think that it's a good question, because I think oftentimes people get confused. They think, well, Thelema is a type of, because we talk about Thelemic magic. You think, well, okay, so Thelemic magic is a species of ceremonial magic. Maybe it's a species of Golden Dawn magic or some kind of offshoot of that. Or is it like some kind of species of paganism like you're asking? And yes, it can be understood that way. Although I think that can be a little bit confusing, because the way Crowley defined magic was more as like a life philosophy. It has more in common with that. So what you end up finding in practice is that you have people with lots of different sort of religious backgrounds and different techniques that they're doing, but they're all united by this interest in individualism, individual expression, and really creating your own relationship with the divine on your own terms. Does that help at all?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Any other questions? Yeah.
I like what you had to say about the vulnerability of sensuality and the relationship between being vulnerable and courage. Because can you say more about that?
Yeah, because there are... So... We have this saying in our religion from our holy books, fear nothing at all. The fact of the matter is that you can't control fear. Fear just arises. And so the way that I have come to understand this is that you need to learn to carry fear. You need to create a container for it to carry it around. That's where that heightening of consciousness comes in that I was talking about, and turning toward it and not succumbing to that reflex to run away. And so, and fear is the emotion that is most likely to come up once you begin to turn around, right? That's why we don't turn around. As soon as you begin to confront vulnerability, the fear is there to program you from not making yourself, keep yourself invulnerable. So it's the first thing that's gonna come up. There are other emotions too. You might experience disgust, for example, or revulsion of various kinds, or anger is a really common one. Resentment, but a lot of that's driven by fear, right? So yeah, I would say that if you're going to open the heart requires the capacity of courage, because courage is the capacity to carry fear. Does that make sense? Any other questions? Seattle-OTO.org. Please come up and grab one of our beautiful flyers or one of these beautiful flyers, and I'll hang out for a few minutes, and members of our community are here too to answer any questions you might have. Thank you very much.